This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
I'm just a mean green mother from outer space and I'm
green. Welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we break down the biology of movie monsters. Today we are looking at 1986's Little Shop of Horrors, the movie remake of an off-Broadway musical that was inspired by a movie that was in turn inspired by a couple of different books. We'll go over some news first, tell you a bit about the movie, our thoughts, and then we'll get stuck into the science that this movie brings up. Basically, Adam and Dave and I will wax lyrical about carnivorous plants until we drop, and then Libby will talk for a bit about alternate endings and the pros and cons therein. As always, the show's broken up into a few different segments. There's time codes below, and skip ahead to the bits you're looking for. But before we get into that, my name is Sam Van Oss-Perrin. I am a freshwater/invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based up in Trondheim, Norway. With me, as always, is co-host and fellow editor at Ecology for the Masses, Adam Hasik, a parasite/disease ecologist currently at the University of Arkansas still, yeah?
In about 1 month, be flying over to Israel.
Oh, and then I can never again mispronounce Arkansas.
You can mispronounce Negev.
Yeah, just start mispronouncing Negev. Yeah, well,
Ben-Gurion. And on his way to the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. alongside Adam is the Baroness, Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. And as every week, we are joined by Dave, our vet and movie physiologist. Whew, how is everyone?
Oh, not so bad.
Yeah, good. How are we feeling about Jurassic World Dominion coming out next? As a very clunky segue into our first news segment.
I was going to say, let me give you a segue. You asked how I was. So I went to the gym the other day and I'm just feeling really sore. Some might say dinosaur. That's all I got. Speaking of dinosaur.
Speaking of dinosaurs.
It was a long walk to get there and it wasn't worth it.
No.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Maybe after another cup of coffee, I'll get there.
So Colin Trevorrow, who was directing the upcoming Jurassic World Dominion, basically said in an interview that Jurassic World Dominion asks a single question: if dinosaurs lived among us, would you be safe? And the answer is no. First reactions.
Isn't that what all the Jurassic movies are about?
Yes.
Well, I mean...
Exactly. Like, the top comment on this on Twitter is, we answered this in the first fucking movie.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But, like, even then, that movie posits a world where you're a unprepared group of tourists, effectively, at this park without any weapons or training. If dinosaurs got out in the world, cool. I'd like to introduce you to the U.S. military, which has so many goddamn weapons. We could kill everyone and everything on this planet like 10 times.
Yeah, the comments that say it better than I could is some people, so Jojira, Goji underscore Soros on Twitter says, some people really underestimate how much a gun would fuck up most dinosaurs. and then there's an example below of somebody who said, the most unrealistic part of Jurassic World is that helicopter's high caliber machine gun didn't shred the Indominus in seconds. And then somebody said, to be fair, it didn't hit her, to which the reply was, that is a matter of sheer incompetence, then how do you miss something that big?
That's the one trope in movies that I'm tired of, is seeing like high caliber machine guns or sniper rifles have like the tiniest little entry and exit wounds.
Yeah.
Like that thing will take chunks out of you.
Yeah, we a little throwback to the other week when we watched Predator, when Jesse the Mind the Body Ventura uses his minigun and just lights it. Well, not him. Bill Duke uses the minigun to just light up the fucking jungle. I'm like, this is like the one time in a movie where you see what a gun would actually be doing to anything in the vicinity.
It's like, raise a jungle.
Yeah.
There was another comment down here which said, y'all have never clearly watched bullets bounce off an alligator's hide. But alligators get hunted down for their skins all the time. Rhinos are almost extinct. Like, we could make
bigger guns.
Just bigger guns.
Yeah.
There's a gun called an elephant gun. Guess what it kills? Everything. Literally everything.
But that's our news for this week. And lastly, before we get into the movie, I just want to send a quick shout out to the people over at Kaiju Weekly, Trav and Michael. I was on their show. It'll have just come out yesterday. It was last weekend for me. We had another look at King Kong 2005. Trav actually threw a fun quiz at me this time, which was, name the US state that this obscure, sometimes obscure, monster movie took place in. I have a limited knowledge of US states, but I think I did okay. I got 4.5 out of 10. Okay. And I put the question to them, and now I want to hear your responses to this, you three. Which male character from King Kong 2005 would you swap out for a non-male character, for a non-male actor?
King Kong.
Not King Kong. You can't say King Kong.
Damn it.
Trav said Cate Blanchett instead of Jack Black. I said Brie Larson instead of Andy Serkis.
I think Maya Rudolph. Don't I think Maya Rudolph
dare
instead of Jack
touch
Black.
Andy Serkis.
Yeah, we're not touching Andy Serkis. He's untouchable.
You're talking about swapping within the cast, or are you talking I can take any actor from the outside world and swap them into a role and gender swap them?
Yeah, swap them into a role, yeah.
I think Maya Rudolph for Jack Black.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to say Tilda Swinton for Adrian Brody.
Nice.
I think Tilda Swinton for Andy Serkis. If we have to replace him, Tilda Swinton would be fucking great for it.
Dave, you got something for us yet?
I do. So what I was going to say, because Sam is the one who encouraged me to watch this, I would totally switch out Jack Black for Melissa McCarthy.
Oh, no.
Really?
Podcast
no.
We're done. Goodbye. It's been fun, guys.
Boo this man! No! No!
Little Shop of Horrors is about a meek, little nerdy dewdrop of an assistant named Seymour, who works in a flower shop, and his boss is struggling to keep the business afloat, so he has this idea to promote business by putting this new exotic plant that he found mysteriously at a market in front and center of the window display. Yes, and so thus becomes this weird dynamic of feeding this plant to keep it alive and growing to also raise success for the business. We soon learn that the plant only eats blood and human flesh. And there is a love story between him and the other. Is she an assistant? I don't know what her
role is.
She's
like the receptionist slash...
Oh, no, she's the florist. She does the arrangements. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there's a romance between him and the lady who works there who does the arrangements.
Audrey One.
Yeah, her name's Audrey One.
Yeah. Audrey.
What I liked about this movie is everything Steve Martin does. Not his character, of course. I'm not saying I advocate for domestic violence. But every scene he is in, he is just so over the top. Like, he is just living life. It's
Steve Martin?
It's funny to watch. Yeah, he's just having a great time. The Dentist, You'll Be a Dentist song, is the first song I enjoyed. And pretty much every song after that I loved. Levi Stubbs as Audrey 2.
So good.
Just kills it. So amazing. Amazing. R.I.P. Levi Stubbs. That plant still looks great now.
Incredible.
For 1986 too. I mean, I know we're already getting kind of close to when Jurassic Park came out and CGI revolutionized everything, but it still looks good now. And like I said, the back half of the songs are great. My personal favorite is Mean Green Mother. Mm-hmm. I re-listened to that song so many times.
I really loved Rick Moranis in this and his use of physical comedy. Having like the extension of the weed come out just as like, I've got you by the balls, and it kind of like knocks into the area. I'm not really a big fan of the use of that sort of, and they just did it so well. The pulling down the pants and smashing the table and all of his interactions with the plant are great. And I loved Bill Murray's quick cameo as the sadist meets the masochist in the dentist office is just such a still to this day loved scene.
Yeah. We should also say at this point that both Dave and I watched the original ending.
Yes.
Where the plants take over.
I mean, this is a movie that I've really enjoyed since I first watched it back in 2015. I'd heard about it for a long time, all those cultural references, the songs, all that fun stuff. Then finally seeing it, it very much, it's a different kind of movie, obviously, but it strikes a very similar chord to me that the Rocky Horror Picture Show does, which is just this fun, over-the-top sci-fi monster musical that just has such catchy songs and a great, amazing, charismatic villain voiced by an incredible singer. So I'm all about it. And then all the little, the filler with all the other filler, I say, with, you know, Steve Martin, Rick Moranis, all these wonderful actors playing these amazing roles.
I want to preface this by saying that way back when Sam and I first met and became friends and he started talking about Adam, the first pictures that he showed me of Adam were Adam dressed up in Rocky Horror Picture Show garb. And he was like, this is my friend.
Surprising no one.
Right. That Adam comparing a movie as similar to Rocky Horror Picture Show is one of the greatest honors that he can bestow upon a film.
Absolutely. It really is.
Yeah.
That was a picture in his Bumble profile.
Yes!
Yep.
Absolutely was.
You gotta know what you're getting in for, baby.
So, when I was a child, I've obviously heard about this movie. I, for whatever reason, I really, really wanted to see this movie. But I had this weird... Sorry, this is like a very long-winded story, so just pop up your feet, grab a cup of tea. I'm getting into it. So I've always really wanted to see this movie, but I've purposely stayed away from this movie because of this weird stigma in my head where I really set this bar that I wanted to watch this movie with someone who really enjoyed it. And I don't know why. That's what I wanted to do. And it was the same with Rocky Horror, actually. So I never saw Rocky Horror growing up. I never saw this movie growing up. And I really wanted to see this movie because I knew that I would like it. I love Rick Moranis. I loved, you know, all those guys, Steve Martin, Jim Belushi's in it, which was a fun cameo as well. So I really wanted to see this movie, but I didn't want to watch it alone. And I don't know why, but I just really wanted to see it with someone who would enjoy it in the same manner that I did. So I actually stayed away from all the songs as well. So I had zero idea of like what this movie was going into it, other than I think I'll like this because I know who's in it. And holy fuck, I was just so it was so worth the wait. Like all these years of wanting to see this movie, it was so great. It is, I think, one of the most perfect. I think it's one of the best examples of a farce. I think that farces can go kind of wrong because it is exaggerated and over the top. And I think that they just hit that category with a perfect 10 out of 10, you know, Olympic score.
In terms of what we didn't like about the movie, I feel bad because she's the only human female character, but the voice that Ellen Green does in this movie is piercing to me. I almost turned it off at one point. It's just that American accent in general, I can't take. Because the character is obviously incredibly tragic, especially if you watch the original ending. But I just wanted her off screen every time she was talking. It was awful. And the songs in the first half, none of them... I just wanted them to go away. The songs in the second half, though, loved everything. So, yeah, those are my only complaints.
Building off of that, I think that was... Until this watching, I'd always felt the same about Ellen Green's character, her portrayal of Audrey. I didn't mind it as much this time, but if I had to find a fault with that movie, it is that deliberate choice by her to, you know, play Audrey that way.
I was her choice.
I mean, she was the original actor in the stage version of this.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been doing this character long time. So it definitely works. It makes sense for the character. For me personally, like Sam, I hate that voice, so I don't like it.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I can like. If I have to pick something about this movie that I don't like,
I disagree. I think she did awesome.
She did do awesome. I just don't like it.
I think it works for the movie because it needs to be over the top. She can't just be like this perfect, picturesque female. Like, for me, I did not like the original ending. We'll go into this a bit later too. There is two endings. There's a theatrical release ending, and then there's the original intended ending. And I did not like the original intended ending. I much prefer the theatrical version.
Really? Okay.
Yep.
I uh, I had some trouble with the domestic assault stuff not aging particularly well. I understand it's being played for laughs and it's creating this like bad guy that needs to be destroyed, but I had really hyped this up for my partner, and sitting next to her at a couple of points when like they're making jokes about the ace bandages or the broken arm or the black eyes, and she was like, "This is a movie you love," and I'm like, "It's very different when I was younger." She still loved it. I still love this movie. But that did not age as well as I remembered.
The only trivia I had was that this was, like we said before, originally this was an off-Broadway musical, which was based on a 1960s. Okay. A 1960 horror comedy film called The Little Shop of Horrors, which is very similar. And that was apparently based on a couple of other films that purely picking this off Wikipedia, by the way. Green Thoughts is a 1932 story about a man-eating plant. The Reluctant Orchid is an Arthur C. Clarke film from 1956, which both of them kind of contributed to this. But the thing that I think is most interesting is that the 1960 version actually features Jack Nicholson in a five-minute cameo, which, and I'm taking a quote from a review of it here, "Oh, and it does indeed feature Jack Nicholson in a quick five-minute role. From the packaging, you would expect him to be playing the plant."
Yep.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
I mean, he does have the same, like, menacing smile.
He looked horrifying.
Creepy man. Yeah.
He played Arthur Dent, Bill Murray's character in that version.
Fun bit of trivia that I have. So, speaking of Bill Murray, he improv'd that entire scene.
Whoa.
They just let him go.
Wow.
Yeah. Typical Bill Murray. Just show
it
up.
Like he was having fun. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's so good.
I think there's a couple like milliseconds where you can actually see Steve Martin like trying not to laugh really hard.
Yeah. How could you not? Yeah. That character is so ridiculous. So funny.
They don't.
There's a couple bits of trivia I have. As far as this movie was nominated for two Academy Awards. Best Original Song for Mean Green Mother from Outer Space, which is the first song by a villain to be nominated. And then it was nominated for Best Studio like Effects or Creature Design, whatever that award
like
is.
Special Effects?
Special Effects. Unfortunately, this movie came out the same year as Top Gear and Aliens.
Top Gun, not Top Gear.
This one lost to Jeremy Clarkson punching a guy in the face. as Top Gun and Aliens. So Aliens won Best Special Effects, and Top Gun won Best Original Song for Take My Breath Away.
Take my breath away!
For the Is creature, speaking of, exactly, thank you. For the creature specifically, the Frank Oz's crew were really worried the plant didn't really look that good when they tried moving it around, but they figured if they filmed it on a slower shutter speed and then sped it up, it looked a lot better. So they had to play Levi Stubbs' voice slow down and pitch down for Rick on stage, and then Rick himself had to sing or make his mouth move at a slower speed to match the plant because they'd been sped up whenever they were on screen together.
He did slow-mo acting and slow-mo singing. Cool. But there's no stop motion at all.
No stop motion at all.
You know, I feel like we used to do this, and I just want to like briefly introduce this for a second. You can cut this if you don't want to. But
no.
I feel like I would like to see who would win the Audrey 2 puppet, the big one, or Treebeard puppet.
Well, the Treebeard one only had 17 people doing it, so. But it was big enough to hold, Dominic, Monaghan, and Billy Boyd, so. Some substance to that one.
This is the first time we've done a plant, I think, since our second episode.
Yeah. It was an animal, we decided.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Well, this one might be too.
And guess what? Yeah,
we took a massive cop out, yeah.
We'll come back to Biollantia eventually. Maybe have Travis on for that.
Far worse than Godzilla.
In the experiment, I thought I'd created an immortal plant species. I think now I may have made a mistake.
Okay, so before we get stuck into carnivorous plants, If you've got any thoughts or questions, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I am at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Harsic Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit our website, cinematicaanimalia.com, or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. Just type in Cinematica Animalia and you'll find us. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and sign up for fortnightly emails with new stories. And if you want to hear about some more less movie-related ecology that Adam and I and a huge team of international writers write about on a weekly basis, you can check out ecologyforthemasses.com. So, obviously, carnivorous plants are a thing.
Mm.
They've evolved a bunch of different times, actually. Carnivory has evolved separately, they think, or they thought at least 5 years ago. I'm not sure how much it's progressed since then, in at least 5 different genera. So a genera is kind of a big group of species grouped into one thing. Our genera is Homo, for instance. So we're in the same genus as Homo Neanderthalus, Neanderthals, Homo Erectus, some others that don't have funny names, presumably Homo Floresiensis, the hobbits. That's mm-hmm. our genus. In 5 separate genus of plants, carnivory has evolved independently of each other, convergent evolution. It normally happens in areas where nitrogen, lots of minerals in the soil, but generally nitrogen is really deficient. And plants have plenty of water, because a lot of the time they're in the tropics, but they don't have the minerals needed to grow. So they will get it from other sources, in this case, animals. And there are at least, I think, 700 different species of carnivorous plants spread across 12 families and 20 different genera and 5 orders. So an order is a massive grouping. So there's tons of different carnivorous plants out there. They're actually fairly recent. The oldest fossil we have, I should say, is about 35 to 45 million years old. So this is a recent evolution. And most, like I said, have evolved around the tropics. Because tropics, I mean, we think of them as these places full of life, but the soil in the tropics and rainforests is often really, really nutrient poor. Adam and I heard this tidbit from a fellow researcher, Guillaume Patouin, when we were in our masters. And he was talking about the fact that tropical soil is often really helped out by winds blowing dust across from the Sahara Desert. And we were both at the time like, no, that sounds stupid. There's no way that can happen.
What do you know? You're from Canada.
Yeah. Turns out Guillaume was right. We were definitely wrong. It's a real thing. It does happen, and it's extraordinarily cool.
They found a lot of Saharan dust in Colorado as well.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. It's amazing that we're able to figure out where dust comes from, by the way. Yeah. Because James McAvoy still hasn't managed it.
Sam. Soil.
I was about to make a fucking awesome Golden Compass reference there, and you just cut me off, you asshole.
You're welcome.
But some of the things that we see in this movie do turn up in carnivorous plants. And we're going to go through them one by one. I'm going to explain what they are, and then Dave is going to explain the physiology, because I fucking hate physiology with a passion.
Hey.
It's finally come out. Dozens of episodes down the road, same as admitting it.
Particularly plant physiology is just beyond me.
I do have a quick question before we kind of dive into Audrey 2. Mm. In real life carnivorous plants, at least from my understanding, a majority of what they eat are insects.
Yes.
What is sort of like the largest thing?
Rats. There is a carnivorous plant we will talk about today that has been shown on rare occasions to eat organisms as large as rats. It's not
rats.
It's not.
Are we talking like NYC Subway pizza rats, or like
they are big. They are big. They primarily mice are far more common, but there have been a couple of examples where they have found rats within, and you can find terrifying pictures if you look them up.
But hinged mouths is the first thing. So Audrey 2 constantly opening and closing her trap.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm not derogatorily talking about a mouth. I'm Venus flytraps here. So
you're saying she talks too much, now, Sam? Yes.
Her big old trap. Got it. There.
Exactly.
That's why you gendered her.
Constantly flapping a trap. Yeah. But okay, so Dave, you take over when I start to falter, okay? So how I believe it works in Venus flytraps is that their leaves are held apart with tension constantly, right? And when something walks on it, there's an electrochemical signal that releases that and snaps them together.
So sort of, in terms of, it's less of a bear trap in terms of its mechanism, and it's more of a muscle ready to contract or spring, just using a very different system. So the trap is basically controlled by changes in water pressure. So turgidity would be the basically a turgid change. And the idea behind the Venus flytrap that makes this so fucking cool is that it takes two pieces of sensitization. So inside of the Venus flytrap, they have these little gated triggers. They almost look like hairs that if they're pressed down on, they will activate a signal saying something's inside. They can be activated with 1/10 of the insect's weight, which is apparently important depending on how insects displace or shift their weight when they're walking. But it requires two pieces of sensitization to take place. So they have to move at least two of these hairs. And the reason they do this is to avoid dust or other material getting in, causing the Venus flytrap to then close and wasting the energy that's associated with that closing mechanism.
And then they have like a second mechanism to prevent this sort of closure if there's something too small, right? So for instance, a lot of Venus flytraps will close to a certain degree whereby the teeth, I guess you want to call them, interlock, but it doesn't close the whole way. And that allows anything that's too small to get out so that they don't have to go through the entire process for something that's a tiny meal. And then the second stage is it closes up and goes like seals tight.
Yeah, as far as we can tell, it has to do with the triggering that takes place after the closing. So they need an additional 5 points of sensitization or pressure inside of moving those hairs to trigger that they have something large enough that they then seal.
And then once that happens and everything's sealed shut, that's when the digestive juices start to pour out, right?
Yeah. So basically the edges of the flytrap close in. The pressure that's made by the insect moving around inside continues to trigger, causes the plant to complete the connection. It then seals itself along the edges and then starts to release digestive juices inside to start to break down the organism. And at the end, the only thing that's left over after approximately 10 days is just the chitin husk. So chitin is just what makes up the insect shell that gets left behind. And then the plant will reopen and it just kind of drops the chitin shell out. Sometimes it will get stuck and it can be broken again. Flies are not good about avoiding the graveyard of their friends. And then it's all set to sort of...
They don't have like a chitin spittoon nearby that's like...
I mean, that would be really cool, don't get me wrong. And we will talk about some mechanisms by which these plants get rid of the chitin afterward, because the one that you guys included in the Discord group this morning does. But generally speaking, it just kind of opens up and dumps.
What's-her-face? Audrey does have those teeth. So those teeth, they wouldn't be used for chewing, of course. They would potentially be used as a further interlocking mechanism. You know, as well as the lips, to just make sure you keep all those digestive juices in there, because those take energy to produce, so you really don't want to be wasting them. You don't want anything leaking out, which is why there's that second shutting that makes it completely, like, sealed off from the outside world. But in this case, then, you're saying, so if an acid can decompose, it can't decompose chitin, are you saying that when Steve Martin's body parts are finally digested inside there and Audrey 2 opens up again... Would there be a skeleton?
There wouldn't just be a skeleton. There would also likely be clothes and shoes, which is why I was really happy when he kills Steve Martin that he says, chop him up for me. He doesn't say eat him like whole. And he was like, chop him up. And I thought he was going to chop him up and strip the pieces. And then he starts throwing them in. I think realistically, the plant would be like, no, fuck you. I don't want a shoe. I don't want the goddamn shoe. Like, give me the foot.
Get his cool motorcycle boots off.
Right.
Yeah. So perhaps the most realistic of all these deaths is when Munchkin kind of falls in and then Audrey closes on him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But, I mean, and to bring Libby in early, because he feeds all these people to the plant at nighttime, I feel like that doesn't impede the story too much, because it's not like there's any... 5-minute window where Seymour, you know, runs in the middle of the daytime, shuts the shop windows, feeds him a person, and then reopens. Like, Audrey could have been digesting overnight.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't see that in the movie, right? Does that change the movie too much, Libby?
No, I think it works perfectly. The only thing I'll say with the movie as far as the eating is, no one seems to care when the shop owner dies. Like, Steve Martin has this whole inquisition.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, just Rick Moranis is in charge of the shop, or like nobody.
Mushkin's just gone.
Yeah, Mushkin's just like. Whoop.
you may not get this because, you know, you're not in that club, but when a doctor dies, it's a seriously important thing. They definitely, they want to go looking for those doctor bodies.
Good point, doctor.
Thank you, doctor.
Yes, doctor.
Thank you, doctor.
Yeah. For the Venus flytraps, although the energy it takes for them to close, if you see a Venus flytrap in a store, or if you happen to be in one of the places where you can see them in the wild, don't stick your fucking finger in it to make it close, because that is just killing the plant slowly.
Yeah.
Okay, so second group of carnivorous plants that have a really cool mechanism that we do kind of see here are the sundews. Now, the sundews do what Audrey 2 does at a couple of different points, which is ensnare somebody in her vines. Yeah, they sing. Yeah, they're yeah. mainly baritones, but you do find a couple of high tenors in there as well. No, but they are capable of ensnaring insects. However, these plants also digest them on their tendrils. Mm-hmm. They have kind of a stretched out, I guess tendril is the best word for it, with a lot of little kind of spikes. They look like spikes with what look like drops of dew at the end of every tendril. And what happens is something will land on these and all the tendrils will start to kind of fold in on that one little thing. And all the tendrils will kind of bend further in. Why am I acting it out? This is a fucking podcast.
Listeners, if you could see this now, it's incredible. Sam has actually painted himself green for this occasion. Uh-huh.
He is singing and dancing.
I've done some amateur acupuncture. Yeah. How do you know? It doesn't matter. But so all the tendrils will kind of fold in and attach their little dewdrops to this unlucky insect. Yep. And they will actually digest it in that state. They don't bring them in or wrap them into a mouth like Audrey 2 does. They just digest them right there on that tendril. Yep. Now, there are some species that are capable of getting out of this. There is a brilliant video online of a spider just going fucking nuts and managing to extricate itself, which is really hilarious. And I suggest everyone check it out. But as soon as enough tendrils get stuck onto an insect, that insect's pretty much fucked because they just stuck there.
Yep. And
well, that's what I was going to ask. So I know with Venus flytraps, like one of the things I've always wondered is when you see them shut, it's not like a, you know, it's not instantaneous. And the same with the tendrils. I can't imagine them just like snatching and grabbing really quickly. So how common is it for insects to escape that like slow grasp or slow clutch from the tendrils?
Pretty
not super common, I would guess.
No, it's a pretty low percentage. And the reason is that the juices that attract the organism have a sticky consistency and they contain the digestive enzymes. So you're luring someone into a vat of acid being like, climb in here. It's a hot tub. It's warm. And you like you.
It's like a hot tub of your own stomach bile.
Right. And the problem is there are a lot of insects like Adam that just cannonball into the hot tub and then are like, oh no, I made a terrible decision.
I regret this immediately. Yeah.
In the hot tub.
In my hot tub.
Now, and also the really cool factor about this that I thought had links to the movies is when those tendrils have finished digesting, when they unfurl to basically realign, they unfurl and drop the decomposed chitin body that's left behind after, which means... I think Rick Moranis is probably before the shop opens in the morning sweeping up bones. He would definitely have to be getting up and sweeping up like the bones and the other pieces that this plant kind of leaves all the way around it. And would have to be really careful with the TV crews coming in to be like, no, you can't come in today. You definitely cannot come in today. Come in like a week, maybe 10 days.
Give me an hour to sweep all this up.
Right.
Oh, what? Nothing.
So far, I think this is pretty plausible. Until you have to scale it up. But I have a solution. I think this occurs in the same universe as Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And therefore, everything works out just fine. Uh-huh.
That would explain, because my biggest problem with the movie was how the hell are they repotting this goddamn plant? They have this ginormous, you know, room-sized pot. And I just want to see who exactly is lifting... that pot, lifting Audrey 2 up into that pot.
I will make the point here that we have said that the whole reason that carnivorous plants exist is because they need to get fertilizer. They need to take care of soil that is mistreated. At the end of the plant or the movie, Audrey 2's plant container is in such bad shape that it erupts its roots out of the side of it. Mm-hmm. I posit that if Rick Moranis had simply switched out the dirt that this plant was getting on a regular basis, it would not be eating people. And when he is singing all through the movie and he's like, I've given you all these things, the only thing he's not giving it is fresh fucking soil. That if he planted it and it could have got its nutrient base.
You do have species, though, that have evolved in extremely nutrient-poor environments, and if you try and transplant them into nutrient-rich environments, they just die from overload immediately.
Mm.
They freak the fuck out. They're so used to extracting every little thing they can from a very nutrient-poor environment that they just get overloaded and die.
Yeah,
but
it's like a man who's been trapped inside a small room for 15 years coming out to a like full sunlight in his face.
But I do hope that if he'd switched out the dirt a bit more commonly, or at least got this thing a bigger sized plant, he might have been able to at least cut down on the frequency at which he needed to feed it.
Yeah. He tried.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole Grow For Me song is about that. He's like, I've done literally everything I can, like levels of moisture from desert to mud. And Audrey's just like, nah, let me get that blood, baby.
Okay, so the last species or group of carnivorous plants that we should talk about is pitcher plants.
Those are my favorite. I love pitcher plants.
Now, there's not too many similarities here, but I just want to talk about one particular species of pitcher plant. Because most of them, basically slippery rims. Somebody goes up there to get nectar and accidentally falls into the plants.
You have to specify. It makes the whoop noise and then they fall in.
Yes.
While windmilling their many insect limbs.
Uh-huh.
It's a plant that's evolved to take direct advantage of pratfalls.
Yeah,
exactly. But there is one species, and I've fucking forgotten the name, that provides nectar for shrews in a very particular place, such that the shrews have to shit into the plant.
Perfect.
See, I thought you were going to talk about Nepenthes attenborough, which is named after David Attenborough and is the second biggest pitcher plant in the world.
They're so cool.
Nepenthes
Attenboroughii.
Is this the one that eats the rats?
Oh, god damn.
Yeah, this is not the one that eats the rats, but there is the largest species is the Nepenthes Dianiana, which produces a giant red pitcher-sized trap. That has been found to basically swallow giant centipedes, 10-centimeter long spiders. And in certain examples, they have been able to find the capture of animals as large as rats. The largest is the Nepenthes northiania, which is the one that is capable of capturing rats and has also been shown to capture mice as well.
You know, I always love pitcher plants, and now that I know that it eats centipedes, I just love them even more.
But centipedes are our friends.
No.
There was a lot of furore in the press in about 2009 when they found a bunch of rats in there. Like, it blew up because, you know, rat-eating plants.
Was cool.
However, they have said that it's not an overly common thing. Like, it doesn't happen all the time.
No. And I mean,
that's just what the plants want you to think.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I've seen that documentary.
I believe it's quite similar with bird-eating spiders. Like, we literally call them bird-eating spiders, but it's not what they're snacking on all the time.
And it's pretty bad for them in the long run with all that calcium.
Yeah.
I love a version of Libby working as the press agent for these plants and being like, we don't eat humans that commonly. It's really rare. Let your children wander in the jungle. It'll be fine.
You got 4 kids, right? Most of them will survive.
The mechanism associated with this is a much more simple system of you fall into the plant, into the trap, and then you drown literally in the happy nectar at the bottom of it. That then breaks you down, and a lot of the mice and rats that have been pulled from these are in very partially digested states even after a long period of time, indicating that the plants can work with but really aren't designed for this type of organism. So one of the mechanisms I just quickly wanted to talk about, because it's fun, and I was not as informed as I probably should have been before doing the research for this podcast, that generally speaking, eating blood is a shitty way to get your nutrients. I had grown up on Dracula movies and been like, that's fucking brilliant. Let's get the blood because it's full of all the nutrients because it's the highway of the body. Thank you, Bill Nye. No, it's really nutrient poor, generally speaking. It contains a large degree of iron because you got to break down all that red blood cell that's in there. And the proteins and the other material that are all stuffed together, they take a lot to break down. Mosquitoes, which are the thing we obviously think about most commonly when we're thinking about blood-eating organisms, generally speaking, both male and female mosquitoes eat flower nectar. The only time that female mosquitoes decide that they need a blood meal is to get proteins that they need in order to produce eggs. The proteins are pulled into that sequence. They're broken down basically along the cells lining their gut. And then the mosquitoes have to get rid of all that heavy iron material, which is a big process afterward. Now, there are other...
And again, it's a really small percentage of mosquito species that ever consume
blood. Yeah. And again, all they're after is that little bit of protein to jump it up so they can make eggs. And they need that to stimulate egg production. There are bigger organisms, the most common one we talk about are the vampire bats, that look to consume blood. And there's a big discussion among ecologists, this may be something Sam and Adam can comment on more, about why they evolved to do this. Blood really doesn't carry that much nutritional reward. Every time that a bat drinks blood, they're exposed to a whole host of diseases, including rabies, Ebola, and HIV that can affect them. Yeah. And it, on top of the life-threatening diseases, as we talked about, there's a shit ton of protein. They need to have specialized kidneys to break all this material down.
I can't speak to the mystery surrounding vampire bats too much. What I can speak to, and we have spoken about these things before, is vampire finches. Mm. The mystery there is fascinating because they have only found these quite recently. I was lucky enough to interview Dan, and I'm sorry if he's listening, Baldassar, for butchering the pronunciation of your name. One of his students was one of the people who went out and did the first work on this. Cool. And he said the more interesting mystery isn't why the vampire finches feed on the blood of the gannets or boobies. One of those two species, they look very similar. I can't remember which.
Boobies.
Let's just say boobies because it's more funny. What they can't figure out is why the boobies let them do this. Because they just sit there while the finches are drinking their blood. And they can't figure out why.
Cool.
I mean, it could be one of those things where this doesn't really make sense from the point of view of if you're feeling pain, pain has evolved as a way to tell your body to stop doing whatever you're doing. But yeah. It could just be such a novel interaction that has recently evolved that the birds just have no idea what to do about it. Like, the story with the dodo and not evolving with natural predators, and so humans just come along and can fucking kill them, and then the dodo like wanders over like, huh.
They could just pick them up.
There's a dead dodo, weird. Yeah. And then they get killed, and then the other one's like, huh. Two dead dodos, and that one gets killed, and it just continues.
There's written journals of how sailors would come to the island and just literally be able to pick the birds up with their hands because they just had no fear of predation.
So ridiculous! I would love to see a dodo.
And it's not limited to sailors. Darwin's fox, a species of fox that was found in the Galapagos Islands. Charles Darwin collected the first specimen that went into the museum because it walked up to him and he just cracked it over the head.
I don't know why. I'm not saying that Audrey 2 couldn't survive off of blood as the first meal that Rick Moranis starts feeding it. I just don't know why it would. There's not a lot of nutrient that it would need for growth that we traditionally see. The byproducts that most carnivorous plants are after have to do more with the tissues and the breakdown of the tissues than they do from anything that would be found in the bloodstream.
Yeah.
No,
I thought you were done.
Well, the last quick point that I wanted to talk in, because I think this is going to make Adam and you very happy. The biggest feature that we see that I was rewatching it and I was like, oh, that's fucking cool, is that Audrey 2 has the ability to lure in humans. That's its first marker, is that when he brings it up and he puts it in the window, humans start coming in and they start buying tons of shit. They just want to see the plant. Now, we've talked...
This strange, peculiar plant.
Right.
Yeah. And we should have mentioned this earlier. That's how pitcher plants work. There's a lure. They are bringing things
right.
in.
Right. Yeah. So, and carnivorous plants, that's exactly it. They have to have something that draws the insect in. A nectar, a sugar, something that gets them to come in that they think they're going to get a free meal out of it. And they end up getting digested.
Stench of rotting flesh, in the case of Rafflesia.
Corpse flower.
So... The question becomes, there are three different mechanisms that I thought could be at work here, and I'd love your guys' feedback on it. The first, and we've talked about this briefly before, would be pheromones. if this plant is releasing something that's creating a positive interaction. Now, the thing is, most of the pheromones that we realize act in humans are important in cases of sexual reproduction, which means that everybody coming into this store wants to fuck the plant. That they're basically walking by and they're being drawn in by high quantities. And the first guy, the reason he seems so awkward and so weird is that he comes in and he's like, that's such an interesting plant. I wasn't expecting to see here. This is not what I thought I was going to get out of this. I'm embarrassed.
He said with his raging boner.
Right.
You only showed him from the waist up.
Right.
By the way, Christopher Guest.
And then once they're inside the store, the embarrassment takes in of they've been sexually attracted to a plant and they're like, fuck, I need an excuse. And they're like, I will buy roses if you never mention this to anyone ever again. So that's
like so that. You think maybe these plants have an advantage if there's like animal bodily fluids in the soil.
Basically,
nearby.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I wouldn't be leaving anybody alone at night with this plant if that's the case. Now, the last two options. One, I wonder if there isn't something that it's secreting into the air to make these people so happy and manic, because when they show up, they seem friendly, excited, they want to buy things. If there's some sort of narcotic or some other thing that's interacting with the brain that it's aerosolizing and putting into the air, which is also making people do stupid shit, like a weak man who's been afraid of people his entire life, killing three people, including his adopted father and the love of his life, and putting them into the plant within the course of like a couple of weeks. There's definitely a possibility there of there is something fucking with your normal brain chemistry if you're in close proximity. And then the last and most interesting one was, I wonder if there isn't some smell that maybe humanity just hasn't wandered onto yet and McDonald's has been searching for its entire existence, that will draw humans in droves, the same way that insects will come in looking for a sweet smell. I think everybody has a smell that sets them off, that they're just like, ooh, like what is that food? What is that grouping that draws you towards it? That if there was something
gasoline.
So, if there was
Sex Panther,
something so powerful,
6% of the time it works every time,
that it would make you come into this store and feel so happy that you would just start buying shit.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if it is actually just human flesh, because just breaking into the lore of like Sweeney Todd, you know, you have those meat pies that are made of humans and people go absolutely crazy for those as well. So maybe we just have not. We're not accustomed to smelling human flesh cooking. And it's just like very enticing.
Apparently it smells like pork, which is delicious.
Long pig.
Yeah. Long pig, exactly.
There was a fantastic tweet today by our guest Arthur next week, who pointed out that 40% of UK people say that human life is worse the same as animal life. 12% of the UK is vegetarian, which means that 28% of the UK would eat a human being.
Eating all the bodies, actual cannibal Shia LaBeouf.
I really appreciate all the time we take to explain and relate Audrey to other plants in the world, because I think Audrey's a reptile. Some kind of alien reptile form where, much like a jellyfish, it goes through a multi-stage life cycle where you start out as a sessile organism that cannot move. So a jellyfish, for those of you that don't know, they aren't fish, the jellies. They swim through the water very slowly. They don't really have a centralized brain. They have that distributed nervous system. And that is just the later and adult part of their life. Early on in their life, they form what's called a polyp, where they are anchored to the seafloor or to a rock or some kind of substrate. And they grow up kind of like a plant, but they are still an animal. Eventually, the top of the polyp will pop off and swim off. It's called the Eritrea, I think it's called. Not Eritrea. it becomes this small country in Middle Africa. But no, that's the juvenile stage, which eventually turns into the adult medusa, or the swimming jelly that we are all familiar with. So I think that the Audrey life cycle is much like that, where early on in its life, it is rooted in the ground, or at least sits on top of the ground in some way, much like a plant. And it has evolved this mimicry to look like a plant to maybe protect itself from predators. How it stays away from herbivores, that's another argument for another time. But it has evolved this mimicry to then stay away from predators. Eventually, using some kind of chemical motivation, chemical attraction, it brings in potential prey items and potential helpers. So it has evolved to be a social parasite. You see this in nature with things like the slave-making ants, which will go into another ant hive, use chemicals to trick the ants into thinking they're part of a different hive, bring them back to their to the slave maker ants hive, and then make them do the work for them while they just kind of sit back and keep controlling them with chemicals.
So Rick Moranis is a slave ant.
Yes. Well, Audrey's the slave making ant. Yeah, Rick Moranis would be the slave ant, yes.
Putting some support behind Adam's reptile idea, if this plant, as it gets thicker and thicker, basically is pulling in that material, it's doing the digestive processes in the lower half of the mouth, because it seems to have that tongue, but then it's got all that empty tissue underneath, and potentially pulling the material once it's broken down enough into the stem, it could have a similar breakdown process to something like a python or anaconda that's kind of breaking it down and then eventually moving it out, or even having a system more similar to a owl, where it can, because again, as Adam loves to point out, birds are reptiles, being able to spit up some of the bone or shoes or other undigestible material out as it continues the digestive process. And then the last most important point that Adam very much obviously intended for this was that if it does fall more into the reptile category, it could have some set of lungs, which would give it the ability to sing.
Boy, what a singing voice.
What a singing voice, indeed.
The best voice in the movie. Yeah. Although Rick Moranis, close fucking second.
Oh, no, sorry, Steve Martin's dentist. Oh, maybe he's not a better voice, but that song.
I'll be a dentist.
And I enjoy all this pain I inflict. Just incredible, yeah.
Oh,
By the way, that woman he's punching in the face is Australia's own Miriam Margoyles, who people might know as Professor Sprout.
Oh, from cool.
Harry Potter films.
Yeah.
You'll find a way to make your natural tendencies pay. You'll be a dentist. You have a talent for causing things.
Just before we turned over to Libby, though, I want to talk about the fact that carnivorous plants in general on the planet, again, not doing super well. Deforestation in large parts, again, mainly for cattle grazing, have ruined territory for a lot of these plants. And of the species we know about, roughly 70 have been assessed as critically endangered, and a further 47 as endangered, and a further 104 as vulnerable. There are a lot more species out there that we just don't have data on. If you want to help out, again, consume less of everything, particularly beef, because, yeah, forest and habitat loss is a huge problem for any species.
Huge. Mm.
But Adam, you also had an example of local issues where these plants have gone extinct for a different reason, right?
Yeah, so the Venus flytrap, which everyone tends to think about a very exotic and very fun plant, is native to North America, specifically the Carolinas, a very specific area within the Carolinas, which are a southern state in the U.S. And there's a lot of swampy land in that area, and that is where Venus flytraps are from. They're from a very specific set of habitat requirements, so you can only find them in very specific areas. And because of the potted plant industry and people wanting carnivorous plants in their house, they have been basically, quote, hunted almost to extinction by people going in and just uprooting all of them they can find and just taking them to go sell them. So they are very vulnerable from that sense of point of view as well.
I think you can find Venus flytraps in, like, Hobby Lobby.
Yeah.
Like, it's weird.
Yeah. Also, don't go to Hobby Lobby. Fuck those people.
And it's hard to know, because a lot of these things are locally sourced and grown, and it can contribute to, you know, people finding out more about plants and that sort of thing. But a lot of them are, yeah, illegally sourced, and it's hard to know what's what. So, I don't know. Ask your shop owner if you're thinking about buying one of these. Where did you get the plants from? Yep. Hope they give you an honest answer.
So the biggest thing that I wanted to talk to y'all about today was the alternate ending. So we went into it a little bit in the beginning of the pod, but I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about the trivia of what happened with this movie and then just go into some examples of why this might have happened. So first and foremost, what did you guys think of the alternate ending? And for listeners who have not seen both, the original, I guess you would call director's cut, is where Rick Moranis' character and Audrey, the Audrey one, die by the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Rick Moranis gets eaten, the plant wins, and then takes over New York City, killing thousands and thousands of people.
The entire country.
Yeah, with the with
along
the
with a lot of other plants as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the implication that it's global domination. And then the theatrical release is where Rick Moranis, Audrey lives, and Rick Moranis kills Audrey too via electrocution.
Mm-hmm.
They live happily ever after, but there's like a little wink and nod that Audrey too has survived with one of her little podlets.
Yeah.
So what did you guys, did you like both endings? Did you not like, which one did you prefer?
I much prefer the original.
Yeah.
It is very, Adam, Libby, and Dave have all called me out on this, that it is very drawn out. But I love that song, Don't Feed the Plants, at the end. I did not like Rick Moranis' character. I liked Audrey's character, but her voice killed me. So I was happy to see them both die. And I just wanted more Levi Stubbs. So, yeah, I'm happy that the plant won. I preferred the original ending, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I'd only ever seen... Sorry, Dave, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I agree with Sam. I watched the original, the happy ending as a kid, and I didn't get to see the director's cut ending until this rewatch for the podcast. I would repeat that he killed his adopted father. I don't really want
to... To be fair, who bought him as a slave.
And he said treated him like shit.
He did. He treats him like shit, but he is giving him an opportunity to get away at the end. He's not like, I'm going to straight up like throw you to the police. He's like, and yes, it is financially motivated for give me the information on the plant. But, you know, it's not all evil there. And ending with the happy, yes, he murdered a couple of people, but you know what? They probably weren't that great either. Is not really, as opposed to the everybody sucks and the plants take over, I'll take the everybody sucks route.
Yeah.
I think I was the opposite of Dave, where I have only ever seen the original ending in this watch for the podcast. Oh, so the okay. First time yeah. I've seen the quote happy ending. And I did not like the happy ending.
Yeah.
I think that it's way too much of a Deus Ex Machina where everyone just wins because it's a movie and they have to. And it's just like, this doesn't work. This whole movie has been set up as Rick making mistake after mistake and having to pay for it. And I will say that the movie should have ended after Audrey 2 spits out Seymour's glasses. That would have been the perfect ending. I don't need 5 to 10 minutes of the same plant bursting through a building.
On and over, on.
And over and
totally
over.
Totally agree with Adam here.
Oh, it's such a love letter to like Godzilla and kaiju films of just model buildings being destroyed.
Go back to your kaiju podcast.
I don't need 7 minutes straight of that.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me personally, I completely understand the complaints about a ending that is wrapped up neat in a, you know, romantic little bow. But I had a hard time narratively getting behind A, killing off your two mains, and then B, just having the absolute verbal or visual diarrhea, as I called it, at the end of this movie, where it just... All of a sudden, you're just like, what the fuck is happening? I turned to Adam and I said, do you think they just lit up a dube and went to town? Mm. Like, this is just like, what in the hell?
Yeah, but hear me out. It'd be really cool.
Yeah.
If.
It was like Frank Oz had a wet dream. It was just like, guys, listen. So it was just too much. I think for me, the theatrical release was enough where... The whole movie is a farce in of itself, and I don't think having that, as Adam mentioned, the Deus Ex Machina of him like magically grabbing this live wire and electrocuting Audrey, I think it was believable, right? Like, you have this whole movie where you're like, okay, yeah, that could happen, because the whole movie is ridiculous in and of itself. But yeah, so I kind of wanted to bring that up because when they made this movie, the ending of it was, sorry, let me start over. When they made this movie, they did something which is popular when you're making movies in post-production called test screenings. And so they test screen this with a select audience and see how they react. And then movies can then make post-production changes to better suit kind of how the audience is reacting to it. A lot of movies have done this with good success. I think Goodfellas is a good example of this, where they almost completely change. I think it's Goodfellas, but they completely changed the ending based off of, or not the ending, the entire movie, based off how the audience was reacting to it. And so they did this for this version, and the audience completely hated this ending.
Really?
Yes. So they, one of the reasons was they figured to, and I should mention in the off-Broadway, the original ending of the plants taking over, that is the ending of the play. And so they kind of went with the script there. But they understood the concept of when you have actors in the theater, your two main leads that die, when you're watching it as a play, you know that those people are still alive. But if you're watching it as a movie, that movie is more reality. And so when you kill off your two main leads, you completely disconnect your audience. So the audience hated that they died, and then it just went on this whole big literal rampage. So they changed it based off of that. And I should note that that original ending cost $5 million to make. Yeah. So that was a $5 million wow. mistake.
Big money in the 80s. Jesus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I can understand.
So,
I can understand the desire to just use something if you've paid for it. I've definitely been in situations before where, like, I hate this bottle of wine, but I did spend $16 on it, so I'm going to drink it. If I spent...
What's the word? Sunken cost?
Yeah. If I spent $5 million on an ending, oh, that would hurt to not use that.
Yeah. And it is interesting because in Hollywood, there is a very much love-hate relationship with test screenings in general. I should say, this is kind of interesting fun fact, Harold Lloyd is often credited for the inventing of this concept, which if you don't know him, you should look him up because you'll probably recognize him. He is one of the most famous silent film stars, up there with Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton.
Cool.
But yeah, it is a love-hate relationship with test screenings because oftentimes it takes away the creative voice. So you have this exactly like... Little Shop of Horrors, you have this ending that's just kind of bananas, and as you know, a writer and director, they were having fun with it, and then the audience and producers come in and be like, nah, you can't do that. You gotta change it. So there's a lot of love-hate with it, because oftentimes it lends to editing the movie in such a way that the creative team behind it has to suffer. But then you end up with a lot more successes because you're actually testing it with the marketplace, so to speak. There's a fun little list of, there's a lot of big movies that the endings have completely changed by having either a character die who would have survived or vice versa. And those movies, including Little Shop of Horror, are also Mary Poppins, Final Destination, Fatal Attraction, Deep Blue Sea.
Wait, hang on. Who was going to die in Mary Poppins?
That's a good question.
I'm not sure. Yeah, it's a very good question. Deep Blue Sea, I Am Legend, Titanic, and Pretty in Pink. So those were all test screened, and the audience reacted poorly to the ending, and they changed it completely.
The only one of those I know where I'm more informed on the story behind it is I Am Legend, and I think that's a huge mistake that they
agreed
with the... Yeah.
Do we feel bad for Audrey too?
Fuck no, she can kiss my ass.
I'm sure she'd like to eat your ass.
Gorgeous voice, but no. Sorry.
Agree with Sam, the murderous plant that wants to eat everybody and spread itself across the world is not a character I have a strong feeling of happiness towards.
Yeah. I would feel bad, but goddamn, is Levi Stubbs so fucking charming. I'll accept it. It's just an animal trying to live its animal life, and it's just smart about it. And it's a really good singer, so I'm here for it.
Do they ever go into why or how it got teleported down onto Earth?
Just that little lightning bolt that happened.
Lightning bolt, yeah.
But is that Audrey too? Like, does it have that power?
I think the implication might be that there was a spaceship that dropped it, because there was an eclipse of the sun, which might have just been a spaceship going over.
Yeah.
So this is like potentially another alien world that had this problem with the Audrey 2, and they're like, fuck you, and then they just drop it on Earth.
Yeah.
Would we recommend this movie?
Yes.
Abso-fucking-lutely.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Of course.
So I would, fun.
Which ending would you recommend?
I'd recommend the original.
Yeah, the director's cut.
I mean, to me, both. Like, I think that you can watch the theatrical and kind of see how audiences watched it, and then just do a quick YouTube and then watch the madness that ensues.
So, next week we'll be joined by Dr. Danny Rabiati, a carnivore expert, right?
Yeah, worked mainly with African wild dogs.
African wild dogs to be joining us for The Lion King, 1990s own. Well, the 1990s. Mm-hmm. I think it was 93?
94.
Another musical.
Yeah. With another ambiguously gay villain. I'm here for it.
Yeah.
But, as we say every week, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
It all began in this little shop.
Ow! Damn roses!
Where, strange as it seems, something extraordinary happened.
I'm afraid it isn't feeling very well today.
No, it's not.
What kind of a weirdo plant is that, Seymour?
Little Shop of Horrors.